Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. You know, typically at this point in the introduction, it's not uncommon for me to say how much I am looking forward to the show. And that's always the truth. However, today is different. I am really looking forward to the show. Our guest speaks the same spiritual language that I do, one of meditation, silence, and deep contemplation on the verities of life. Only our guest speaks from another dialect. Nora Deklesis is a Zen Buddhist master with special expertise in practicing the annual tradition of Zen Rohatsu, which is the title of her most recent book. Her book, Zen Rohatsu, serves as a backstory of why we meditate, live mindfully, and have a spiritual practice. At this point in the introduction, I would normally offer up an overview of Nora's accomplishments, but as typical with those in humble spiritual practices, Nora, I have found, is quite private. It's almost impossible to even find what we might consider a bio or resume. That's because I think Nora lets her work speak for itself. I can say this. For more than three decades, she's been devoted to her spiritual practice, as well as leading retreats, guiding individuals, and writing books. Nora has authored at least 14 books, and at least two of them have been Amazon bestsellers, including the book we will discuss today, Zen Rohatsu. With that, let's bring on our fascinating guest, Nora Deklesis. Welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Good evening, Charlie, and thank you so much for having me on tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be great fun. I read your book, and, you know, Nora, I have to tell you, you can write. This book is a delightful journey into the history of the Buddha and Buddhism, with a special emphasis on the personal implications for its teaching. I love it, with this beautiful piece of, I'm calling it poetic prose, all about a personal journey experience of yours. I was hooked from the first page, and for our readers, it's only 100 pages, so you know you're looking at an hour or two read that's worth 10 hours read. Nora, one of my goals today is to better understand the essential nature of Buddhism. I think that so many Americans see the tradition as one of merely sitting cross-legged for hours pondering your navel. Now, don't you think? I mean, that's our impression.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So, you know, I would love it, Nora, if you can begin our time by, as you do in the book, by briefly recounting, and I don't know how brief it can be, but the story of the Buddha and how he achieved the state he called enlightenment. I think that can give us insight into the process.
I agree. I think the history of Buddhism in general is an important component, and as you now know, having read the book, I start with that. We take a look at a man who was born a prince, not just a man, but a prince to a kingdom. And almost immediately after he was born, he lost his mother in childbirth, and his father raised him to be a warrior. But that was not the path he chose to take. So he was raised in a very affluent, wonderful municipality in northern India as a prince. And as he got older, he realized that he was going to explore beyond the walls. He married, he had a child, and he still went over the walls to find out what life was really like. And his first exposure was essentially to be setting. He didn't feel that he wanted any of his princely goods. He took his jewels and his clothing and his hair, his beautiful hair. He, by all accounts, was a very handsome guy and had very long, black, curly hair. And he cut it. And he went on his way without eating very much or without drinking very much. And he walked and walked, trying to find the meaning of life and enlightenment. And it didn't happen. Year after year after year, it didn't happen until one day he sat down
Can I ask you real quickly, how many years, does anybody have any idea the years that he wandered in that process?
Six or seven years, we think, yes.
Okay.
Approximately 6 or 7. And at that point, when he sat under that sick tree, he decided to stay there and wait until he found this enlightenment. And his enlightenment is what is celebrated on the holiday known as Rahatsu. It's celebrated by Zens, which is a division of Mahayana Japanese Buddhism. And what he did during that time was he came to the conclusion that he had an idea of what enlightenment was about. And it was in some ways very diagnostic and very prescriptive. He came up with the idea that basically we are suffering because, for the most part, we're attached. We're attached to things, ideas, anxieties, stressors. He didn't call them that, of course, but in our language, that's what he was talking about. And then he came up with the Eightfold Path, which basically said, you know, neither poverty nor affluence is the way. The way is to look at this in the middle path, to take a moderate path and understand that if we don't lie, if we don't cheat, if we don't commit any of the moral or ethical sins, then possibly we will achieve enlightenment by being mindful, which is written directly into this. That's the seventh component of the Eightfold Path, mindfulness. Not really what we see on the internet, but rather with the Buddha telling this to us, teaching this to us in as the primary source. And I think that's an important component. So he lived both. He lived both very rich and very poor. And he felt someplace in the middle it had nothing to do with materialism. It had to do, spirituality omits materialism and looks directly at a very introspective look at what's important, what is important. And ethics are important, morality is important, meditation is important, and not becoming attached is important. And that's the essence of what he taught until he was almost 83 years old.
I find it interesting because we're going to talk about this later, about the integration or complementarianism in the, I believe, 15th century, 13th century AD is the movement of Buddhism into Christianity with, we'll talk about the Jesuits and Ignatius of Loyola. And, you know, so many people, so many scholars, you know, sort of poo-poo the integration of Buddhism, like, you know, well, we're getting into another religion and we can't get into Buddhism and be Christians at the same time. And yet the two are so complementary. When you talk about ethics and morality and, you know, goodness, there's, you know, I find the two being very informative of one another. Do you not?
I do, and that's why I did go very deeply into St. Ignatius and Xavier and the way in which they not only approved of what they saw, but carried it to the West.
Yeah,
They were the missionaries that we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because that's, you know, as somebody who is, you know, deeply involved in mystical Christianity, it sparks my attention. But before we get there, I want to go back to the Buddha and I want to go back to Rohatsu and the book as titled Zen Rohatsu, and that's Rohatsu. Rohatsu. What is Rohatsu and why is it important to you?
It's important to me because it's an annual reminder of why I meditate. I'm a meditator. I'm simply a Zen meditator. It's the area that I've chosen. And what it does on the eighth day of the 12th month every year is it reminds us of what the Buddha, historical Buddha, Siddhartha, actually did and the way in which he did. And he simply sat. He sat and he meditated. And what we do is we celebrate that every year by reenacting it. And the guided visualization that I wrote at the beginning of the book was exactly that. It was exactly the way in which I have sat in meditation during the first week of December for many years, many decades.
You do that with a number of people. You do that with your own Sangha, is it?
Sangha, yes.
Sangha.
It's called a Sangha. Yeah, we're simply a meditation Sangha. There's no scripture. There's no monastery. There's simply a group of people. The group that I have affiliated with is very prominently affiliated with Plum Village, which was where Thich Nhat Hanh taught Zen.
Oh.
So Zen is one division, one of many ways in which people practice Buddhism. Similar, for example, to Christianity, the Tibetan Buddhists are under the direction of the hierarchy, I guess, of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The Zens are not. So much the same way as, Baptists would not be under the jurisdiction of the Pope, for example.
Oh,
so
no.
Very similar. Very, very similar. It's analogous. There are many Protestant denominations. There are many Buddhist denominations. Zen is one. And it is one that was carried from India by the 28th patriarch in Buddha's lineage named Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma took it to China, and then it went to Japan. And when it went to Japan, that's when the Christian missionaries found it. So that's another interesting component. So Zen is what they actually did find. And Zen is actually how they learned to meditate.
Are there any specific differences between Zen and Buddhism itself that you could articulate that we can get an idea of how it may be different from Buddhism?
It's not different from it. That there are, Christians are all on the same path. For the most part, they have a different service.
Right.
Exactly the same for Buddhists. The analogy there is you can walk into various types of Buddhism, and they might simply chant the entire time you're in their sangha or their monastery. You can walk in, and they might be doing koans, and it's very different, from zazen, which is what the Zens do. The Zens meditate.
Zazen is meditation.
Yes. And Zen, the word Zen, actually, it comes from the Sanskrit. It means meditation.
Oh. This is so fascinating for me because the entire conversation is a learning experience. I am not steeped in Buddhism, although what little I've read, I appreciate so deeply. Let's get before we're going to get into I don't know what you call it, but it's the Dharma, but I would call it the theology of Zen Buddhism, and so that's probably oxymoron, but that's the way my brain works. The Dharma is the teaching of
Buddha, historical Buddha,
of the historical Buddha. So before we get into the details, and I have four or five details that I have read, and as we talked, I thought would be really fascinating for our audience. I would like to go a bit deeper into the practice. That's a question. I'm sorry, that's a question later. I want to speak very practically. How can I, as someone who's interested in Zen Buddhism, how can I be served by beginning to employ more Zen or Zen Buddhist practices? How does that serve me in my mystical journey? And everybody, no matter who they are, even atheists, are pursuing some sort of, whether they call it spiritual or not, it's an inner, soulful sort of journey. How can I be served in that journey with this discipline?
Zen teaches us, Zen meditation teaches us how to be calm in the chaos. That's for everyone. That's for every sentient being who walks the planet. Zen has a very simple way to stay in the present. It teaches meditation, it teaches equanimity, and when I used to teach it, and when I do write about it, I actually tried to put it into six concise points, because those points were easier for the layperson, like myself. I mean, I am not a monk. I am simply a meditator. But it's easier for me to explain my journey. Now, they all begin with an S, because sometimes I do teach this in corporate America. So if you let me go through these very simple concepts, and I use the mnemonic device. You know, if they begin with an S, people have more of a tendency to remember them. Now, in Zazen meditation, we basically sit. We sit for about 20 minutes. Some people sit in chairs. Some people sit on zafus, a small pillow, which is on a larger pillow called a zabutan. And during that time, a bell rings and we get quiet. We lower our eyes to half-mast and we get quiet. We don't move. And when thoughts come into our head, what we do very simply is we let them pass through. Now, Dogen, who was a Zen master in the early days, kicked it up a notch. So here comes the first S. He called Zazen, without moving, for his monks, Shikantaza. That's the only technical term I like to use because it's the style that I do. When I sit Zazen, I don't move. And that simply means no matter what, I might sneeze, but I don't wipe my nose. When I say I don't move, I don't wiggle my toes. And there are no thoughts. I'm not thinking. I'm simply meditating. The second thing that occurs during the course of the day,
I want to ask a question on the first one because absolutely. I've practiced meditation. I know you're better than three decades into it. I've practiced it for 4 years now. I am very good at the first half of your explanation. I do not move. I do not scratch. I do not itch. I don't, if my nose is running, I don't touch it. I don't do anything. So I find, even Nora, if I just accomplish that, that is a moderate success in my meditation process of just completely calming down and not focusing on my external circumstances. But when entering the meditative process, and that where it is a matter of clearing the mind and focusing on whatever, I struggle with the monkey mind. My brain is highly, I'm sure you understand as well read and intelligent as you are, that is a battle, is it not, of beating that those overwhelming thoughts that are coming in? So I'm half there and half not there.
And even for the experienced meditator, it happens, and it happens frequently. And what I teach or what I suggest in the book is we simply change our thinking before we meditate on how we're going to handle that to some degree. And meditation practice really helps. For example, in a zendo, where you might do zazen or zazen meditation, i.e. shikantaza, the more advanced style, you're going to hear noises. You're going to hear the fire truck go by. You're going to hear birds chirping. And rather than chat about it with the person sitting next to you, or rather than chat about it in your own mind or in a sub-vocalization, what you really want to do is think this. It goes like this. Bird chirping, it went in one ear and it went out the other.
Yeah.
And then you just get back into the meditation.
Yeah, kind of naming the thought, and then really naming whatever that comes across, name it, okay, thought, and then release it is what I've been taught. Is that?
Exactly correct, and that works very well with some practice, and it is a practice. It is very much a practice. So Shikantaza is even better for me after many years because, as Dogen said, not thinking, just not thinking. And now, how did I get to that stage? It got to that stage by walking meditation. And that's something that is very clear in that opening part of the book.
It is.
We talk about keen heen. Now, if you were to get up and do some walking meditation for about 5 minutes after 20 minutes of seated meditation, if you can be in a walking meditation, you're going to feel really good about your meditation in general. So walking is a very important part. Keen-heen is a very important part.
Is that still part of the Shikantaza?
It is walking. It's a different style of meditation. Walking meditation is exactly that. We stand and we walk around the zendo without cutting corners. So there are things that we do. For example, we don't scratch the face because the itch comes and the itch goes. So it's a lesson learned. We don't cut corners when we walk around the zendo. We walk almost at a 90-degree angle when we hit the side of the zendo so that we don't cut corners in life. Because this Zen is about living our daily life, which you'll see with the next part of what I'm talking about.
Well, let's move on to the next part then.
Well, the next part is kind of cool. It's called single tasking. You know how we were taught multitask is everything in corporate America?
Which I hate it.
Single tasking is the essence of the Zen practitioner. Single tasking. Staying in the present and single tasking. If I'm pouring water or tea, I'm just pouring water or tea. My other hand isn't reaching out for the cheese sandwich. My voice isn't talking, to someone three rooms away. I single task. And that's a marvelous way to live your life after you begin the process of single tasking. That's a Zen day. A Zen day exists with lots of single tasking during the course of the day. The third I call stillness, which is slow down our minds. Don't do quite as much. Those of us who are working hard, 12 and 14 hours a day, need to spend as much time as possible remembering to leave some time in between and to single task. We go back to that. And to meditate. I meditate about 2 hours a day. Number four.
I want to comment on that because that's so important because there's, I don't think I did a podcast on it. I think I did a blog on it on Cal Newport's Deep Work or Deep Thought. And he advocates having set times during the day where you are cutting off all external communication. So, you're not getting text or emails, or no one comes into the office, but you're not meditating, you're working, but you're working on, it is single tasking, you're working on one discipline, one thing that's important, and that's where the deep work comes in, and that's where he has found that he is most productive. And so this stillness and slowing down the mind sounds very much like, although it's not meditation, it's still deep work. It's still single tasking. It's letting the brain focus on one thing and one thing only. And great success can come from that.
Absolutely, and I agree with that, and I do that. I do, but that's not part of my meditation for those 2 hours.
Right.
It's part of
my
work day, and it's the earlier part of the morning where that occurs. And, it's similar to people saying we do a silent meal. Well, I do a silent workspace, and it is extremely effective, and it lasts for about 2 or 3 hours, and there are no text messages. you know, during those times, there are no text messages during meals. There are no text messages during meditation. So we really are taught that it's good to have these rituals. And throughout the day, that's exactly the way I spend my day.
Okay, what's number four?
Number four, serve others. Do service. I mean, that brings the serenity that we're all looking for, and it allows us to practice our compassion. And service, I think, is something that almost everyone makes a really good attempt at. I've seen that being the one area where we really don't have to discuss it at any great length. In my case, sometimes my service is as simple as spending a part of my day with a handicapped cousin, and I have for the past 18 years. And he has taught me more than anything I ever learned in graduate school. So the reciprocity exists, and it's just a lovely experience.
I feel like I need to comment on each one because I'm so resonating with them, not because I'm interested in my listeners knowing that I experienced that, but it is so important because, you know, as I read the mystics, and people think of the Christian mystics, that a unitive union with intimate divine union, that union with God is a primary objective. Now, that is true. However, every mystic I have read, and I've read several mystics, every single mystic says, if it does not result in service of humanity, then it is not intimacy with God. It is something else, because that serenity, that closeness, that intimacy with God, we are no good unless we are good to other people. So that service, you know, that's another place where there's interplay between Buddhism and mystical Christianity, is that service to others is essential. You know, to the mystic, you cannot be intimate with God without serving people.
Absolutely. And sometimes it's hands-on, and sometimes it's philanthropic. My church runs Code Blue. Out here in the East, where I am, people freeze to death if they're not picked up in vans. And the homeless are picked up in vans. They're fed, and they're given a wonderful place, a wonderful spiritual place in the church to spend the night on nights that get very cold. That's another alternative to contribute, to participate, and to support financially in some instances. I think one of the things that's very clear to me on this point is that's an individual thing. I very seldom mention my cousin, but I'm mentioning my cousin tonight because of the reciprocity that occurred. He has become a more compassionate human being. Our relationship, has been enhanced by the time that we set aside, and we both take time from our day to do what we do, and we've gotten to know each other very well. So yes, is it Christian? Yes. Is it Buddhist? Yes. Do all religions practice this? Of course, all religions practice compassion, and should. One of the things that was a pet peeve of mine in one of the books I wrote prior to this was my research indicated that people now have an acronym so that they can hold up this little sign that says, I'm spiritual but not religious. And that's about 47% of America.
Right.
And I say you can be both, or you can be, you know, spiritual and not religious. But you can be both, and I think that's what you're saying. You can be both.
Yeah, we could get on to that because I so agree with you, and there's much to say on that, but I'm interested in point five.
Point five is simple living. Simple living. And simple living, what does that mean? Well, to me it means, you know, we're constantly in pursuit of materialistic things, fame, popularity, some of the things, you know, that, you know, they're kind of nice, but it can't be A to Z. It's not the ball game. I did a podcast with a wonderful gal who basically said, my mother taught me when the babies are little to hold them and hug them. And if I needed to vacuum, it could wait. And that really says it all. You know, parenting and the love we express to our children, to our partners and spouses, it comes first. And it comes first in a way that simple living allows it to come first. Because if we're working 14, 15, 16 hours a day, there's really no time for that. So we have to modify our schedules.
Yeah, you know, it's simple living. You know, my guess is it has to do with the busyness that we all face in our highly demanding of productivity. Our high demands of our life on productivity, and there is a time to not be productive in the capitalistic American sense. There is a time for, in what I think you would refer to as mindfulness, and be totally caught up in the present, and that is all that matters. And I think that contributes to simple living. Do you think?
I do. I'm going to add one component on mindfulness. I want to repeat again that mindfulness is found in the primary source. It's found in the Buddhist teachings, and there are artifacts that indicate that exactly took place back during the time of Siddhartha's days. And the mindfulness that is significantly important, I think, is not having any judgment. There are some days when we have to work all day. There are some days when we have to work late into the night. And we can't beat ourselves up over that. We have to have no judgment, which is a major component of mindfulness. Or anxiety is created, and that's what we're trying to omit.
I have never heard that. It makes perfect sense, because judgment leads to all sorts of crazed behaviors. Again, we can go on that, but I'm interested in covering your principles. So let's move to the next one.
It's systematic cooking and cleaning. How's that for a Zen definition? Systematic cooking and cleaning. Now, during Rahatsu, or almost any time that you enter a Zendo for a Sesshin, which is when you do Zazen for maybe an entire weekend, and walking meditation for maybe an entire weekend, there's something called work practice. And during work practice, everyone silently gets up, they get their task, and they go about doing their task mindfully, in the present, and joyfully. And usually the leadership of that Zendo do the pooper scooper. And the hierarchy cleans the bathroom. And there is an egalitarian, what I'm saying, representation by everyone in that particular Zazen to take a job. And the good jobs, the bad jobs, they go to everyone. They go absolutely to everyone in an equal way. And during that time, what we learn, oh, what an important lesson, is that if we stay in the present during that weekend of learning about it, we bring that home, which is why I ran those weekend retreats. We bring that home so that I mindfully prepare the meals, if I'm in charge that day of preparing the meal. And it manifests in such a way that it gives me great joy to smell what I'm doing, to look at what I'm doing, to enjoy the texture of what I'm cooking. That's mindfulness. So sometimes it's cooking, and sometimes it's cleaning. And sometimes it's not using some of the modern conveniences. Now, I made a personal choice not to use the dishwasher. I do not. I wash dishes.
Ever?
No, I've not used the dishwasher in 3 decades. I have not.
That's funny, because I rarely use a dishwasher myself, and I wish I could say it was from, you know, great spiritual intent, but it just seemed I cleaned the dishes so well before I put them in the dishwasher, I thought it was a waste of time. I might as well just dry them off.
Well, maybe you're more into Zen than you realize.
Oh, I am more into Zen than, you know, and I do realize it, you know, even though it's never been articulated as that, but, you know, just about everything you've spoken of, you're describing parts of my lifestyle. You know what's interesting here, Nora, is that the systematic cooking and cleaning work practices and egalitarian practices, you know what? This is in your, did you call it, is this, I'm a bit confused on terms. Is this the Zazen?
Zazen is meditation itself.
Okay. So this is not the Zazen. Okay. But you know what you're describing reminds me of? It reminds me of a monastery. That is the role of the monastery. The monastery is all about several things, but two primary objectives is prayer and work, and that everybody has a job to do, and, you know, they will rotate after a year, they will change their job, but everybody has work, and this work is not considered just, oh, let's benefit the community, although it really does, but it is considered part of your spirituality. And that work itself is part of your spirituality. I have a very fascinating story, and that's of Saint Bonaventure. And Saint Bonaventure was Saint Francis of Assisi started Franciscan, you know, the Franciscan order, but Saint Bonaventure is the one who really moved. You know, he became the leader of the Franciscan order, and he made it. It was his influence that made it such a huge movement, you know, beyond what Francis did, and Francis was amazing. But there's an interesting story of when he became, you know, and I don't know the title, but it was chief of the order, that all of the Franciscans wanted him to be more than abbot. I don't know what, because abbot would be of just one monastery, but all of the abbots reported to him. So they came to him. You know, all of the officials of the Franciscan order came to him, and, you know, they came in all their regalia, and they brought this big mitre, I think it's called, that fits on the top of the head, that's just, you know, the big gold pointy hat that fits on the top of the head of, like, the Pope and people that are in charge of orders. And at the time they presented it to him, he was cooking, and he told them, just leave it out on a tree. I'll go pick it up when I'm done.
Exactly. Exactly.
Isn't that a great story? It just was. He was not about to interrupt his work, because his work was what he was doing right now, and his work was his spiritual duty. I've always loved that story.
Our work is everything we do during the course of the day, from the moment we wake up until the minute we go to sleep. Our work is not necessarily always in a corporate office. Our work is being human, and the way in which we do it is very similar from one spiritual program to the next. They're all wonderful. All types of meditation are wonderful. All types of religious organizations who are teaching how to be more ethical, how to be more moral. I love them. I love everything.
You know, I have some very
specific... In that direction.
I'm sorry, forgive me. I have some very specific questions now, and ordinarily we would have taken a break 15 minutes ago. Paul, what do you think? Should we just go on, or should we take a break?
Keep going.
Keep going. Producer Paul says, keep going. So there are... will depend on our time. I have four listed questions, but two of them are essential. And as I read your work and I read some corollary work on Buddhism, the Buddha seems to be primarily, or I don't know if primarily is a correct word, but most concerned with suffering and attachment, and that if I understand it right, is that suffering is our attachment to to materialism, but I think also some mental suffering, such as anxiety and stress, and that the degree to which my word, not his, that we can detach is the degree to which we can proceed more toward enlightenment. What ideas can you share with me about suffering and attachment to the material?
A lot of what historical Buddha Siddhartha was talking about came, of course, from his life experience. He was sheltered from things that we are aware of: illness, injuries, failures, the aging process, and finally, death. He was not aware that these things existed. His father chose not to be honest in regards to his early training. So when he went over that wall and he started to see things, he saw monks. They looked happy. He saw death he had never experienced. He saw illness and pain and agony. So many of the things that he grouped into suffering and the concept of suffering, actually they have a different word for it. They call it dukkha, which means sort of a nagging dissatisfaction that no one had ever really been honest with him, and he had to experience these things. So he tried to accept the inevitable loss of the expectations that he had, which was revolving around the fact that he had not been properly educated. So he went out, and what he did was he learned that people were after being the guru, the famous one, the one who found enlightenment, popularity, many of the same problems that exist today.
Ego. It's path. You know, we call it in our discipline, we call it ego.
So he took that and he realized the things are really, these things are all very impermanent. And the phrase life is of the nature of impermanence begins to appear in his thinking. So what he thought at that point was that we need to be a little bit dispassionate. And he thought equanimity was in fact what we needed to learn, because it removes the suffering and essentially allows us to maintain a life devoid of the ups and downs. Now, how does that work? Well, it doesn't work by not caring, as some would say. In fact, the word equanimity comes from the language that they spoke during the time of historical Buddha. It's called Pali, P-A-L-I. And what it means, really, is to look over, being in the middle, stepping back and looking at the situation. So dissatisfaction and suffering can be omitted if we detach from allowing that suffering to occur by having a practice of equanimity. Equanimity is the core. It is the core of the entire Four Noble Truths, in my opinion.
It's big in your vocabulary, as we have chatted. Equanimity is a major... a major concept in your work.
And equanimity is a major concept in his work, which is what I'm describing, and which is why I think so highly of the concept. I can give you an example of how it's very involved and engaged. In fact, they have a nickname for it now. There's certain components of being someone who steps back and looks at the situation as the grandparent. They call it the grandparent. Because if the child falls at the park, the parents run hysterically to the child with Band-Aids and antiseptic and maybe an ambulance. And the grandparents step back and say, you know, that's not so bad. He's going to be okay. Do they love that child? Of course they do. Do they care? Of course they do. But they allow themselves the analytical look at the situation before they react to it. So it's not reactionary. So that's equanimity. No ups and downs. You win the lottery? Okay, you won the lottery. Your car, it gets totaled? The car got totaled, but nobody got hurt. No ups, no downs.
That's the middle. Is that not the middle path, would be equanimity?
It is the middle path. It's most assuredly the middle path. And it's an excellent middle path, again, in my opinion.
You know, I read one of the definitions as I was looking up equanimity and trying to understand it, because I knew it was so important to you. I came up with the definition. I'm sure I read it, and then I just put my definition of it. But it is, does it sound right that it's calm and wisdom in the face of challenging issues?
Yes, just like grandma on the playground.
Just like grandma. I love that illustration. I think that illustration is so true. And I have found that in parenting. I have only one son and a daughter-in-law. And while there are different things that they do, they just turned 30 and 29. And, you know, parents want to question, you know, at least 50% of what they do. This is wise or unwise. And I just, maybe because of my childhood and my upbringing when I was 20, and I was a wild man until I was 30. And so I think it helped embed in me an understanding that, you know, things are going to work out. On occasion, you know, there's times they don't, and there requires intervention. I don't want to, you know, I'm also an alcoholic, and so I understand that, you know, kids in their 20s, you can't just ignore that. But with other issues, you know, it's not a matter of ignoring it, but letting time play out and letting wisdom play out in them and giving them some sort of sapiential advice at times, but other times just encouraging them and saying, you know, I'm with you, you're on a learning process, you're on a learning curve, and things will work out as long as you are trying to have them work out. But even if you're not, life has a way of straightening us out if we pay attention.
And equanimity says just that. To look at by definition. It's not just about detaching. It's so much more. It's a more engaged look.
Oh, you know, I can, you know, I think I want to wrap up our session. You know, I have a host more questions, but, you know, I think an hour is what our time limit is. But I want to wrap up the question with, we are talking to Americans, and we are talking to Americans that you are so right that 40% or whatever the percentage is talk about being spiritual but not religious. But that's because of, you know, I think largely I'm attempting to write a book on the subject, but largely because of the punitive and legal aspects of Christianity that are so limiting to life, that keep us from experiencing life, and it is still productive oriented. Let us produce in the name of God so that we can somehow we can earn God's respect or God's presence with us. And that is just not, you know, for the mystic, that is not what the mystic is about at all. And I'm seeing, and I know, you know, you have talked about being, a devout Buddhist and also a practicing Christian. And I'm seeing that there is an incredible, you know, like Thomas Merton with the, are you familiar with Thomas Merton?
Yes.
Thomas Merton, you know, with the Trappist was very much an advocate of, you know, was it Zen Buddhism or just Buddhism?
Yes.
With Zen Buddhism. And the relationships are so clear to me. They don't, you know, Buddhists, as I read, you know, say you can be of more than one religion. You can be Christian and Buddhist at the same time. And I see Buddhism, since, you know, there is no deity in Buddhism, but in Christianity there is obviously a deity, but that Buddhism is the shoe leather to something like Christianity. This is the way we can express and encourage and grow in our Christian faith. And it doesn't mean dissolving or denying or anything whatsoever of our Christian faith. It is just another way, you know, like meditation is, you know, in the mystics, you know, we talk about silence, solitude, and contemplation. And are those not Buddhist practices? And they have, and with Buddhism, there are physical practices rather than just thought experiments. There are physical practices like meditation and like Rohatsu and a number of other things. I just see the integration is so important. And my guess is, since you are both, that you would agree with me.
I am a Zen meditator. And as a Zen meditator, I think Zen meditation creates a more serene life. Every day, I'm allowed to do what I do in a better way, in a calmer way, in a still way, because I meditate. So the part that I've taken from it is meditation. It's one component. I think the chanting that other Buddhists do is marvelous. It's not something that I do. I think koans are fascinating. It's not something I do. So I can't speak for Buddhism. I can only speak from Zen meditation.
From your practice.
And my practice, which, you know, I wanted to share, which is why I wrote the book.
Yeah, I have found myself, and I want to encourage listeners, especially, you know, people who are pursuing the spiritual path, no matter what journey they take, what practice they adopt, is that with this practice of mystical Christianity and my attempts at meditation, and now as I'm going to be looking much deeper into Buddhism, I have found I've been in many cases, I coach, I'm an executive coach as well, working with leaders, and they are all stunned that I do not react emotionally to difficult issues, that I'm able to just sit there and take them. And that is a form that we have talked on this podcast a few times about detachment. I can detach myself from the activity, but not from my love of the person. My love of the person continues, but I am detached from their activity and can help see from a different perspective. And so I highly recommend our listeners to explore these concepts, no matter what genre or discipline they look at, but these concepts of suffering and attachment and equanimity and relationship and meditation and work are just so deeply embedded into the historical Christian, and which I would say truly human, truly, you know, divinely human aspects of life.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write from the primary source. I wanted it to be available to everyone, and I didn't want to deal with the modifications of interpretation. Everything is Zen, 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 usually an adjective. But when you talk in terms of equanimity, as it was written 2,700 years ago, as part of a meditative practice, that primary source made good sense to me. Again, it's the purpose of, you know, why I wrote it the way I did. And it's been very well received.
Oh, yeah, I can see why. You know, just the opening pages, you hooked me in your poetic prose. Just absolutely hooked me. And then as I learned, you know, Nora Deklesis, I've got to tell you, I think you have taught so many of us at least the heartbeat of the discipline you practice, the heartbeat of Rohatsu and Zen Buddhism, and given us a whole different interpretation, and, you know, this the ethical standards and the lifestyle standards or pursuits. I don't know if standards are even the right word, but pursuits are so helpful. You know, I just, what an honor to have you on the Next Chapter with Charlie. You are a gift to me and to our listeners. Thank you, Nora Deklesis.
And thank you. I feel the same way. Honored to talk to you and wonderful to be on this show.
I am going to provide links to your book, to the newest book, to Zen Ruhatsu, and I'm going to put your website on the show notes as well so people can read more about you and find more. But I'm wondering, what if someone in you, because you're in Philadelphia, what if someone in your area wishes to attend one of your retreats? Is there any way that people can, you know, sign up or get a hold of you, or do you have to know someone? How does that work?
Well, you know, as a result of the pandemic, we have been doing Zoom Ruhatsus the past few years. This will be the first year that we're going to be doing Ruhatsu, and we are book solid.
generally, we
sell out. So I thank you for that effort, but generally we do sell out, and this year we sold out 6 months in advance. So it's an exciting time. I don't run them anymore. I am one of the guest presenters, but the team that does run them, they're run, let me answer that question very directly, they're run all over the world, and they're run all over your state and mine. And the single best way to be sure that you're getting the real thing is to go to the last sentence in my book, and I'll tell you it's called zenteachers.org, and you'll know you're getting a truly vetted, ordained person to run that Ruhatsu. There's a marvelous person right in your area, Insight Meditation, I think, if you're still in that area of Southern Cal. And there's one in New Mexico, Roshi Joan Halifax. So there are several in the West. And, of course, you have the San Francisco Zen Society.
What about the one in, is it Yorba Linda or someplace close in Orange County?
No, Hacienda Heights.
Yeah, Hacienda Heights. Hacienda Heights.
Yes, very large one. I don't know whether they're doing Ruhatsu in English. So that was something, you know, you'd have to check. But, yes, that is a Zen facility, Hacienda Heights.
This is a treat for me and I'm sure for my listeners. And I want to encourage listeners to get your book. Really, that it is a worthy read and it is an enlightening read. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you very much.
Well, that's all for today. I want to thank everybody listening for listening to the Next Chapter with Charlie. And as usual, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.